يوسف جلالي بتهران
روباشافة غازا
جروم هيوز بروسلز
سعيد بورزا لندن
راشان ساقلم اسطنبول
سعيد أمين أوليمي كابول
شهانة بات Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Here in Al Mawasi area in Western Khan Yunis is one of the few amusement parks across the Gaza Strip, a place that once represented joy and celebratory moments for children and their families who are welcoming Eid after the end of the holy month of Ramadan. This place that was once vibrant with children and their families, the echoing of their laughter as they are riding these games that are now standing idle, surrounded by hundreds of tents that were constructed by the Palestinian families who were forced out of their towns and were forced into endless cycles of displacement for more than a year now. These tents are now overshadowing this scene of having these games and joy for children.
This park used to be a reminder of fun and joyful times for families. For 2 years now, the occupation has stolen our happiness, depriving us of all our special celebrations. It's Eid, a time when we should be baking cookies and decorating our homes, but instead, we are homeless. Happiness has become an impossible wish these days.
This amusement park was filled with green spaces to receive the families in such special occasions, but what really gave this park its joyful aspect is the existence of many of the games like the Ferris wheel, the pirate ships, the roller coaster, and all are modest games. But today, as the families are welcoming the Eid, these games stand idle. There's no way to power them because the families can barely find and secure their basic humanitarian needs. And now all these games are surrounded by this miserable scenes of tents, of displacement, and suffering.
As we welcome Eid, all we wish for is for this genocide to end. For a year, we have been away from our homes, sheltering in a place we never imagined we'd be. We once brought our children here to celebrate and have fun on this special day, but now we can't even get them with new clothes or offer them safety.
For the second year in a row, the Palestinians across the Gaza Strip welcome the festive Eid al-Fitr with nothing but more miseries and suffering. This place that should be filled with the laughters of children is now covered and overshadowed by the miserable scene of displacement that doesn't seem to end any soon for the families here. Ahmed al-Najjar, Al-Mawasi.
Amid the devastation and despair, the people of Gaza have faced relentless bombardment, starvation, and displacement. Yet through this enduring crisis, one thing has remained unshaken in their collective spirit, their unwavering commitment to their lawful right of resistance.
After nearly 18 months of genocide, the people of Gaza have taken to the streets in an uprising against occupation, mass killings, and starvation, especially in Beit Lahia. The Israeli regime attempts to manipulate and sow division against the resistance is doomed to fail. Our resistance is inseparable from our existence, an undeniable right we will never relinquish.
Despite its advanced weaponry and relentless attempts to crush Gaza's spirit, the Israeli occupation has failed to break the will of the Palestinian people. Its brutal campaigns targeting civilian areas have only laid bare the true barbarity of the regime.
As Palestinians, our heart and soul are with the resistance. Our people remain aware of Israeli conspiracies. What the occupation failed to achieve through military force, it will not accomplish through deceptive plots.
While Israel's genocide continues, a more subtle and insidious attempt is being made, exploiting people's marches against the genocide in Beit Lahia, who erupted calling for the end of the Israeli war.
As the Israeli brutality intensifies, it is clear that the Gaza Strip will continue to be the battleground, not only for physical survival, but for the ideological and cultural soul of the Palestinian people. Ad Ibrahim, Gaza City.
The Israeli regime launched new airstrikes on several towns and cities across Lebanon on Friday in violation of a ceasefire with the Arab country. After two drone attacks, Israeli rockets targeted the Beirut southern suburbs, destroying two buildings.
As Lebanon marked Al-Quds Day, the Israeli occupation forces continued to pound the country, and for the first time since the ceasefire, Israel struck a residential neighborhood in South Beirut in an act which could jeopardize the already fragile truce.
The sounds of explosions were heard. Ambulances and firefighter trucks ran to the site, yet the rallies to commemorate Al-Quds Day did not stop. Hezbollah officials stress that despite the Israeli threats and continuous aggression, the resistance in Lebanon will not forsake Al-Quds.
On this blessed day, and in light of the current circumstances, we say that we renew our pledge to Al-Quds. We will not forsake Al-Quds. Together with all the honorable people in the nation, in Palestine and the Arab and Muslim world, and with the free people of the world, we will hold the banner of Al-Quds.
Palestinian activists also stress that Imam Khomeini knew that defeating the arrogant tyrants and achieving victory is only possible if the Muslims and Arabs were united and mobilized for the sake of Al-Quds.
Our enemies have failed in their attempts to break the resistance despite the continued atrocities. Their barbaric genocide against the people of Palestine and the aggression on Lebanon and Yemen since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. They have tried to weaken Iran since it is the only firm supporter of the resistance in the region, but they have failed.
It is Al-Quds that unites the Arabs and Muslims, and on this day we see the culmination of the efforts to face the common enemy. It is the shout of the oppressed in the region, but it is also the shout of the human conscience to confront the occupiers and liberate the Holy Land.
People of various faiths took part in Al-Quds Day celebrations in solidarity with Palestine and highlighted resistance as the only path to victory against the occupying regime. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Israeli authorities have released Palestinian filmmaker Hamdan Bilal, a co-director of the Oscar-winning documentary No Other Land, after detaining him overnight. Bilal was in Susia, a village in the occupied West Bank, when a group of Israeli settlers violently attacked him. Despite his injuries, Israeli soldiers arrested him instead of his assailants.
Settlers and army, they attacking my home. And they beating me. They continue to beating me. It's like around between 15, 20 minutes until I was bleeding from all my head and face. And finally, after this attack, they took me to the place. I don't know what is it. I stayed there. It's like all the night. They was laughing about me.
Bilal was taken into custody and was held overnight before being released.
On Monday, there was a massive attack on Susia village where my friend and colleague and co-director of No Other Land documentary Hamdan Bilal lives. There was attack in his home and other houses in the village. Settlers and soldiers targeted him precisely to revenge against the success of the movie and against Hamdan as activists in the village that documenting the attacks of the settlers that happening on his village all the time and other villages in Masafer Yatta. This is not an isolated attack. Attacks happening all the time, but this time it was revenge and attack on Hamdan for his success, to try to punish him and to silence him and to prevent him from doing his work.
Bilal's documentary No Other Land, co-directed with Palestinian and Israeli filmmakers, sheds light on the forced displacement of Palestinians. This incident raises further concerns about the growing attacks on Palestinian journalists and activists. As Israeli violence escalates, documenting the reality on the ground is being silenced. Naqa Hamid, Ramallah, Occupied West Bank.
Yeah.
Palestine action supporters out in raucous numbers again outside the Old Bailey courthouse, demanding that the 18 members of the Direct Action Group on trial here be released.
This is a court where people are tried for gruesome, brutal murders. And these people are on trial for actually trying to stop gruesome and brutal murders. In fact, there is a case here today of a couple who murdered their baby and put the baby in a plastic bag. In Gaza right now, people are putting their body parts of their loved ones in plastic bags every day. So the irony is, these people should not be anywhere near a court for trying to stop people from being murdered.
The 18 activists were arrested under the UK's Terrorism Act in August last year for targeting Israeli weapons manufacturer Elbit Systems' Filton facility in Bristol and causing over $1 million in damages to it. Their supporters say the prosecution is not aimed at upholding the law.
The trial is part of a wider pattern, from arrests to censorship. The activists here say the British state is criminalizing dissent to protect Israel against accountability and scrutiny. They argue that standing up for Palestinian rights is being treated as a crime.
Sarah Cote of Stand Up to Racism, Stand Up to Imperialism has experienced it firsthand. She, too, was arrested under counterterrorism legislation, accused of supporting a proscribed organization merely for saying Palestinians had the right to defend themselves.
This is what the British state does. It's the oldest imperialist nation in the world, and it's going to try by any means possible to defend its interests. And its interests lie in the continued genocide of the Palestinian people and the repression of popular movements around the world.
But the crackdown doesn't seem to be working. While the British government treats the Filton 18 as lawbreakers and homegrown terrorists, their supporters hail them as heroes and consider them as political prisoners.
They're imprisoned because the UK state is trying to protect its relationship and its financial ties to Israel. And this is the extent that they'll go to. They're political prisoners because they have been imprisoned not for their actions, but for the government's politics and for the government's allegiances with their military outpost, aka the Zionist entity.
As Gaza continues to face relentless bombing and siege, the protesters here say they won't be silenced, vowing to keep demanding justice despite the risks. Saeed Purza, London.
Under a unified sky, the territorial waters of Iran mirror a nation's resolve, coming alive as over 3,000 naval vessels participate in a monumental naval parade showcasing unwavering support for Palestine. The massive parade also demonstrates the strength and readiness of IRGC's naval forces, sending a strong message to adversaries just one day prior to international Quds Day rallies. This is not just a show of maritime prowess, but a symbol of solidarity, with the flags of Iran and Palestine waving proudly.
This is the fourth year that the naval parade is being held to mark the occasion, featuring civilian vessels from volunteer forces alongside other naval ships. First and foremost, this event sends a strong message of solidarity with Palestine. It also demonstrates to the Caspian Sea littoral states that this body of water represents friendship. Also, it demonstrates that Iran is always ready to support its people and protect its sovereignty against threats, as the parade is taking place simultaneously along the coast of the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman.
The parade, conducted simultaneously in Iran's territorial waters from the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman to the Caspian Sea, features a variety of vessels, from advanced naval warships to smaller boats manned by besieged volunteer forces, all proudly displaying the flag of Palestine next to the Iranian banner.
The event you are witnessing today is a naval parade conducted by the Iranian Navy and volunteer forces. Here at our naval base, 150 vessels of volunteer forces and 30 vessels from the IRGC Navy's northern base are participating in the parade in the north. This parade demonstrates solidarity with the oppressed people of Palestine and condemns the atrocities committed by the Israeli regime in Gaza. Additionally, it aims to showcase the military strength of the volunteer forces and to enhance unity among the various branches of the armed forces.
Ahead of international Quds Day rallies, this maritime demonstrations has turned into an annual tradition, underscoring the enduring bond between Iran and Palestine.
And that's the message from Iran's territorial waters: unity, strength, and unwavering support for Palestine ahead of Quds Day, showcasing Iran's maritime resolve and solidarity to the world. Fateh Masumi, Babolsar.
The Israeli occupation continues to escalate, pushing further into southern Syria and now directly targeting civilians. But the people of Syria did not stand idly by. Residents fiercely resisted the unprecedented Israeli expansion, engaging in clashes with advancing forces and sacrificing martyrs and injuries in defense of their land.
The Israeli occupation attempted to impose its presence by force on farmers in Koya, but the Syrian people naturally reject colonialism and occupation. This led to confrontations in the village, where brave men stood up against the aggression, sacrificing their lives in defense of their land.
The people of Dara and the occupied Golan reaffirm their unwavering connection to Damascus. No amount of Israeli pressure, intimidation, or incentives can change that. Resistance is their natural right, enshrined in international law, and they will continue to fight against the occupation.
The reaction in Dara reflects absolute rejection of the occupation. If Israel's actions go unchallenged, mere condemnations will only pave the way for negotiations that compromise Syrian rights. That's why we support all forms of popular resistance aimed at expelling the occupiers.
For Syrians, history has shown that Israel only understands the language of force. Empty condemnations and international resolutions will not drive the occupation out of Syrian land. The youth of Syria refuse to surrender to an occupier that thrives on destruction and terror, standing instead in solidarity with the resistance in the south.
Neither condemnations nor UN resolutions would force the Zionist entity to withdraw from occupied territories. Liberation can only be achieved through armed resistance. The youth of Syria refuse to submit to this brutal occupation and stand firmly with the heroic resistance in the south.
Despite the delayed condemnation by the ruling Syrian regime, the Israeli occupation continues to escalate its aggression. However, for Syrians, the path forward remains clear: resistance until victory.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei in a meeting with Iranian officials and the ambassadors of Islamic countries on the auspicious occasion of Eid al-Fitr on April 22, 2023. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, all praise is due to God, Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master, Muhammad, and upon his pure progeny, particularly the remnant of God on earth. I would like to congratulate all the respected people here in this meeting, including the heads of Iran's executive branches, our officials, and the ambassadors and representatives of Islamic countries on the auspicious occasion of Eid al-Fitr. I would also like to congratulate the entire Iranian nation who are truly deserving of congratulations because of their behavior and their meritorious deeds during the month of Ramadan. I would also like to extend my congratulations to all the Muslims in the world and the entire Islamic nation. I hope that the Almighty God will bless everyone during this Eid. The month of Ramadan provides the environment for hearts to become closer to each other. All of the various dimensions of the month of Ramadan help to bring the hearts of the people closer to each other, both within the country and within the entire Islamic nation. First of all, the tenderness that is created in people by their fasting, prayers, supplications, and the recitation of the Quran is itself a source for bringing the hearts closer together. And piety brings hearts together just as the president pointed out in his statements. He stated this very well when he said that the secret to fasting is piety. In my opinion, the officials of Islamic countries should use this opportunity to increase unity and closeness among the members of the Islamic nation. Our problem today is division, even though the Quran prohibits division. Do not be like those who became divided into sects and differed. Quran, Surah 3, verse number 105. And it commands us to be united. Hold fast altogether to Allah's cord and do not be divided into sects. Quran, Surah 3, verse number 103. The members of Islamic nation, the Islamic Ummah, are divided. Yes, there are different opinions, there are different sects, and there are different tastes. That's fine. But these different tastes do not mean that we should be deprived of the great blessing of the Islamic nation being united.
We are with you. How about you? Iraby English Radio. Please log on to our website at iranradio.ir.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. Now imagine enduring over 8 years of daily bombings and artillery attacks on your country, coupled with a crippling siege on your ports, denying the entry of basic supplies to your civilian population, the death, destruction, hunger, displacement, and disease that your people suffer. Now imagine that onslaught no sooner subsides that the same nightmare has just become someone else's fresh debacle. Such is the story of Yemen, a resilient people who resisted a Western-backed campaign behind the Saudis to subjugate Yemen can be enjoying peace today and working on rebuilding their war-torn nation, but instead they have chosen to fight for their brethren in Palestine. Yemen's anti-Israel and anti-U.S. operations to bring an end to the genocide in and the siege of the Gaza Strip is a focus of our Spotlight program. And now for our guests. Joining us is Mr. Saad Nimr, Professor of Political Science at Birzeit University in occupied Ramallah. And Mr. McNapier, co-founder of the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign out of Glasgow, United Kingdom. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess Professor Saad Nimr, we'll start with you. Welcome, sir. Your initial thoughts, how justifiably so the people of Yemen today can say we are beat up, we are hungry, too tired to fight, yet they show nothing but will and fortitude when it comes to Palestine, and in fact have implored and lambasted other Arab and Muslim leaders for not doing their part in supporting Palestinians.
I think that maybe the only people who can feel with us quite well are the Yemenis, because they've been through that in the last, you know, for 8 years of a war, which was launched against them, supported by America, and they make them, you know, suffer a lot. And then they saw the same thing is happening to the Palestinian people, and especially the genocide war against the Palestinians, especially in Gaza. And they felt the same feeling, you know, for the Palestinian. And no one stand with Yemen during that period. And they said, now we should stand by the Palestinians. And that's why they were, out of lots of reasons, Yemenis are committed to help the Palestinians. And through the whole period of the war against Gaza, they were joining, and they joined, and they had an embargo on the Israeli shipments, closing their ports, and closing the Red Sea for sailing, or anyone who's sailing Israel as well. And that makes them, you know, feel the same feeling as they felt during the war of 8 years of Saudi Arabia and Emirates, who launched it against the Houthis. Now they are doing the same to the Palestinian and helping the Palestinian when no one of the Arab countries had helped them during this war. And that's why they felt, I think that this is the main reason. And also their commitments as Arabs, as Muslims, as also humans who would help the Palestinian. For all these reasons, they were there to help the Palestinian people in Gaza.
Thank you, Professor Nimr. Mr. McNapier, welcome to the conversation, sir. Thank you for your patience. Just moments ago, less than an hour ago, we had breaking news here. A series of 13 intense airstrikes by U.S. warplanes again have targeted the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, following earlier strikes that resulted in at least one dead and five wounded. Mick, obviously Yemen, at a considerable cost to itself, continues to stand militarily against the wholesale slaughter of Palestinian people in this three-week siege now on the entry of all aid into the besieged Gaza Strip. How do you assess Yemen saying that its stance here is a sense of duty and obligation to stand with the Palestinian people?
It's so clear. It's crisp. It's really good people versus bad people. It's if you were looking at the world from outer space, you would see the genocide taking place in a small place called Palestine, and silence and gloom elsewhere, and active support from some governments. But you would see Yemen. You would see that this was a place where vast numbers of people actually took a practical stand. We know that all over the world, great numbers of people in every country oppose what America is doing. Great majority of people in Britain oppose what America is doing. But we're unable to reach the stage where we can give practical support to the Palestinians facing a genocidal monstrosity, and the Yemenis have taken this action. As Saad Nimr points out, it's the fruit of experience. We're coming up, actually, I just saw, we're coming up to about 10 years anniversary. About 10 years ago, the Saudis commemorated or even celebrated the first stage of their attempts to subjugate Yemen. And in order to celebrate this stage, Prince Walid bin Talal offered all 100 Saudi pilots who were dropping American bombs on Yemen and had been doing so for many years, he offered every single pilot a Bentley car. Now, the revulsion around the world was so great, I don't know if he actually delivered the cars, but it brought into sharp relief the disgusting nature of this extremely wealthy and powerful state, Saudi Arabia, trying to bomb the Yemenis into the ground and thinking 10 years ago that they had succeeded, reached the end of the first stage. So I think the Americans need to learn from this. The Americans have slaughtered people in country after country, it should be noted, quite successfully, in order to crush opposition and drown it in blood. But when they came to a particular country, Vietnam, they encountered a population which was determined to resist, a people, and with a leadership that was determined to resist. That's the situation in Yemen. It's a very different situation in many ways, but they meet a population who demonstrate in their millions every Friday in support of the challenge to Israel, in support of the challenge to the USA, which clearly enjoys mass support, and a leadership which really seems to be determined to pick up this challenge and come to the aid of the Palestinians. It's genocide. Regimes are silent. Many regimes are supporting the genocide, and the Yemenis are coming out practically in support. This will not be forgotten when the history books are written. And I think the Yemenis approach from a tremendous history of resistance, but they also approach from a knowledge. They're sitting in a very strategic waterway. And they can, if they can absorb the punishment from the Americans, they can deliver a significant blow to the Western economy. And they've proven that already. If they hold their ground, then Trump, by the way, Trump was elected on a platform of ending foreign wars, and now he says that he'll bomb Yemen without any limit of time. This doesn't play well in America, but this is what Trump's trying to do. If the Yemenis can hold on, can continue to resist, there are many strong forces which suggest that they could be successful.
Thank you, Mr. Napier. And Professor Nimmer, we know that during the first 15 and a half months leading up to the January 19th implementation of the Gaza ceasefire, Yemenis put a ban on, according to Mr. Napier, the strategic waterways. Any Israeli-linked vessel was not allowed to access those waterways, and it nearly 200-plus vessels were commandeered for trying to get goods into occupied ports of Palestine there. And then next to that, the Yemenis also, they engaged with missiles and drone operations against the occupied ports of Palestine, we know, in support of the Palestinian people. And they said they will stop once the Gaza ceasefire is implemented, and they did. Post January 19th, we didn't see any more operations from the Yemenis. So we have to ask, when we know that that Gaza ceasefire was so pressing and its implementation so effective and it brought so much tensions to an end, why did the U.S. allow it to fail?
Well, you are absolutely right. I mean, the Yemenis had put a kind of a condition. If you cease fire in Gaza, we will stop our operations against the any vessels who are carrying, whatever goods to Israel, military or otherwise through the Red Sea. And they did, because they caused the Israeli really a huge kind of losses, especially when they targeted Eilat port in Rashrash, and also targeted even Tel Aviv with hypersonic rockets. But at the same time, they said if there is a ceasefire and Israel stop this genocide in Gaza, we will stop, because we are supporting the Palestinians, and this is what we are doing. So if you have a ceasefire, we will do it. So when ceasefire goes on, the Yemenis is stopped. and they respected their decision, and they stopped all kind of operations in the Red Sea. And even Israel and the other countries could use the Red Sea and the Arab Sea freely now without any threats. But what happened? Then the Israeli came out and they started this starvation and blocking all the crossings in with Gaza, preventing the Palestinians from food, water, oil, and everything which is related to their daily life. And now for more than a month, a Palestinian now really suffering really a hunger problem. So the Yemeni said, if you don't stop, then we will resume, because this is an act of war. And they just threatened. They didn't do anything yet. Yet the United States, they started bombarding Yemen before Yemeni do anything. It's quite clear that the United States, and especially Trump, his policies in the region definitely is, as Mick said, it's contrary to what he was elected supposedly for. To talk about, you know, peace, and that he want to bring peace into the area, and he preparing that to resume the Abraham Accords, according to him. But at the same time, he's showing, you know, real problems with the Middle East and supporting Israel and supporting what the Israeli wanted. So he start and resume bombarding Yemen again, even before Yemen start any kind of only threat to resume the war, and they gave the Israeli 4 days in order to stop this blocking of aid to enter, and humanitarian aid to enter to Gaza. I believe that the American have an idea that they wanted to put, you know, eliminate the Yemenis from doing anything, and they have the what during Biden administration didn't work. The UK and US, both of them, they bombarded Yemen many times and it didn't work. So Trump thought more power and more bombardment to Yemen, that will make the problem end. But it's not going to end, and the Yemenis are not going to be defeated.
Featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Mr. McNapier, when Abdul Malik al-Houthi, leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement, said in mid-March he gave Israel an ultimatum, a four-day ultimatum, to lift the siege on Gaza, Israel went and allowed the whole ceasefire at that point to go belly up, as you very well know. But Yemen had not resumed its anti-Israel operations yet when, Professor Nimmer's point, and very accurately so, the U.S. started attacking Yemen. So my question to you, the fact that all this could have been avoided if the U.S. would have pushed the Israelis to respect the ceasefire, one, and two, the fact that the Yemenis are dictating terms to the U.S. and Israel, what does that say about the Yemenis themselves?
It says much for the character and the integrity and the confidence, but also the courage and the understanding of the balance of forces by the Yemeni leadership. The Americans aren't used to being talked to like this. They expect everyone around the world to kowtow, to accept their leadership. But you know, I think this is much deeper than a policy. I think that Israel needs to survive in this area as a murderous regime based on the mass killing of Arabs and Muslims. Israel needs to be surrounded by states which are either devastated, like Syria, Libya, Iraq, or clients, supine clients of the empire. Anything else is unacceptable because Israel is extremely vulnerable. We're talking about 6 million Zionist Jews, probably, maybe less, maybe fewer than that, who are prepared to fight, surrounded by 600 million, I think, is one calculation of the number of Arabs. And they can switch on their TV sets and see Arabs being killed because they're Arabs. Muslims around the world can switch on their... They kill Christian Palestinians as well, but they can mainly see Muslims being killed by this Islamophobic regime because they're Palestinian Muslims. How to survive in that area is not easy. You know, if you imagine six people in a room trying to control 600, it's not easy. You have to divide them. You have to make them afraid. You have to terrorize them. It's the same with 7 million and 600 million. So Israel is deeply fragile, and it can only survive in that area as an ethnic cleansing operation by, as I said, devastating those states which refuse to be clients. So I think there's something profound here. Israel wants to continue with the killing, and the price for continuing with the killing is that the Yemenis will come to their aid, and then America has to be called upon to bomb the Yemenis. It's worth pointing out, by the way, that although he huffs and puffs, Netanyahu, when he meets Trump, understands that Trump is the boss. That's clear from recent developments. But it's also clear that the basic idea of Zionism, which sold itself to Britain initially and then to America as an attack dog in the area, a way in which America could avoid becoming entangled because Israel would do the fighting for it. We now see that with the Yemenis coming into the equation, America has to intervene to save Israel, not delegate the role in the whole region of attack dog to Israel. So I think this is a profound crisis for the Zionists. We don't know how this will play out inside Israeli society. Sadnimer's insights into this would be valuable. But I think that America generally tries to solve its problems by great violence, by aircraft carriers, by B-52 bombs, etc., etc. But they seem to have come up against an enemy here, an opponent, which is different from the rest. Because the majority of people in Egypt, of course, support the Palestinians, but the regime is completely different. What you have is a unity between the people in Yemen and the leadership, and that's very dangerous for the Americans and for the Israelis.
And that's the thing, Professor Nimmer, because Abdel Malik al-Houthi, leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement, he's implored other Arab and regional leaders to stand with Yemen and its operations and its stance against the U.S. and Zionist plots, saying that their plans go far beyond the Palestinian people and Palestine, that they are an existential threat to the region and the nations of the region itself.
Well, yes. Let me just remind you with something. When the Yemenis managed to impose this embargo on the Israeli entity generally and prevent the Red Sea delivery of any kind of commercial ships to come to Israel from that side, Israel suffered a lot. What the Arab did, Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and through Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and to Jordan, there was a line of supplies of food and everything which was missing to go to Israel. So Arabs, instead of standing with the Palestinians, to the contrary, they were solving the problems of Israel, which the Yemenis has imposed. So when Abdel Malik al-Houthi is asking all the other Arabs to do at least, you know, the minimum they should do in this case. If you don't want to stand with the Palestinians and to fight Israel, at least don't help Israel. This is something, you know, unbelievable. So his call for the Arab leaders is really because it's shame for those Arab countries, because as Mick said just a minute ago, they are clients to the Israelis and the American supremacy over the area. And let me just, you know, say at the same time, we are talking about also Egypt and Qatar. Both countries are now accommodating talks and the talks between the Israelis and the Americans and the Palestinians in order to have a ceasefire in Gaza. But at the same time, they are applying pressure on Hamas and on the Palestinian resistance rather than applying pressure on Israel. Why they didn't stand up and say, it is Israel who is breaking all these agreements, it's not the Palestinians. But they even they didn't say that, which is the minimum. You've been there and you've been a mediator and you know exactly what's going on. Why at least you didn't just tell the truth of what happened during these negotiations and who break the agreement and who's committed to the agreement? So it's something sometimes, you know, it makes you think of what kind of Arabs and Muslims we are talking about here. So Al-Houthi, when he talked, Abdul Malik Al-Houthi, when he asked Arabs and other countries, you know, to help, at least he would put them in front of their responsibilities, which they are not even doing the minimum that they should do.
And thank you there. And Mr. Napier, let's also touch on Yemen's military advance, its evolution of its arsenal there. When the Saudi-led coalition started attacking Yemen back in March of 2015, I believe, Yemen did not have a remarkable drone arsenal. It had pretty crude missiles at the time. Today it has hypersonic missiles reaching Tel Aviv. It has these super-fast frigates all over the Red Sea. It has multiple types of drones, all homegrown, sophisticated, indigenous-built equipment. In 10 years' time, tell us how remarkable the military advancements for Yemen have been.
Well, I'm far from a military expert, but I do know that it was technological advances which almost allowed the Egyptian soldiers in 73 to inflict a devastating defeat on Israel. Instead, they fought to a draw. It was the technological developments which worked against Israel. I think the same is true here today. The distance between Yemen and Israel is significant, but Israel is very vulnerable with its airports and its advanced infrastructure and its nuclear power stations and so on. Israel's very vulnerable to the missiles that can be fired from Yemen. And the Yemenis have a strong hand. They have been fighting against it was the Saudis who dropped the American bombs by proxy for so many years. Now the Americans are dropping the bombs themselves. But Israel remains very vulnerable to an attack from Yemen. So I think the balance of power is such that I think generally speaking, the Palestinians cannot win their freedom by themselves. Despite the amazing achievements of the Palestinian resistance, they cannot defeat America, the EU, Britain, Canada, etc., ranged against them. This needs to be solved at a regional level. And Israel cannot survive for a year without the active complicity of Jordan, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, and the other regimes which Saad referred to. Without that complicity, they could not carry on the way they are doing. So the genocide can only be carried out with the connivance and the active complicity, as Saad points out. The Yemenis asked permission, I think a couple of years ago, would the Saudis allow the Yemenis to march to fight the Israelis? That's all they needed to do, open the borders and let them go to fight. But the Saudis actually actively cooperate with the Israelis against the resistance. That's the sad truth. And until that situation has changed, the Palestinians will always remain in great peril from this genocidal regime and its local backers.
Thank you, Mr. McNapier. And Professor Nimmer, final question to you. We know Donald Trump has threatened Yemen with this hell on earth to pay if they don't stop attacking Israel and Israeli-linked vessels. He really likes that one. He said Hamas in Gaza, hell on earth, hell to pay. Iran, hell to pay, hell on earth. Yemen, hell on earth. But you remember when you mentioned a fire and fury with North Korea in his first term, that got the attention of the North Koreans. Kim Jong-un met with them a couple times. They sat down, they spoke. But the Yemenis seem very unfazed with the U.S. president's threats. Why?
Apparently, Trump, first of all, he liked this word, you know, hell on earth, and he used it frequently. But at the same time, there is something he missed, that there are, you know, lots of changes have happened to the region and to the world. before, you know, like, you know, I'm not talking about the 60s and the 70s when he could send his troops over any country and defeat this country. Now the whole game is changed, and the way it changed. And after the 7th of October, we have witnessed now something is regional is being changed as well, when Hezbollah and Ansar Allah in Yemen also participated in this war. So he's threatening, but at the same time, he couldn't do anything to Yemen. Sorry. Threatening Gaza with hell after 15 months of genocide. What he would do more? And Yemen, after 8 years of war, which was supported by American, by the way, what kind of things that he could do more to the Yemenis more than 8 years? So the Yemenis, they do know exactly what the Americans are able to do, and at the same time, they can resist them and they can fight back. At the same time, Yemenis are insisting he didn't know even the psychology of the Yemenis and the culture of the Yemenis. And this is something, it's far away from the mind of Trump. He thought that he can threaten anyone and they should comply immediately after his threat. This is something he had to learn, that this is have changed. Neither Hamas or the Houthis will change their mind.
Great input and contributions to the program. Thank you both, and appreciate having you both on. Stay safe to both of you. Professor Saad Nimr, they're joining us out of Ramallah, and Mr. Mick Napier, they're joining us out of Glasgow, United Kingdom. That brings us to the end of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and bye-bye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.